and welcome to another episode of the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio, from creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets. Here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 252. I'm actually really thinking about that whole thing of audio secrets. Why are we keeping secrets here? We don't want to keep secrets.
We're sharing secrets.
Yeah, we're sharing secrets. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I'm Vincent Diamante, hanging out with you guys for yet another GAH episode. You heard for a moment there, Michael Gordon Shapiro. How are you doing?
I am doing splendidly. I've been doing a little bit of frantic last-minute house cleaning in preparation for guests. So if I sound exhausted and lightheaded, it's not you.
That's okay. That's always fun, having to prepare for guests. I'm actually about to prepare for guests myself. And for some reason, I decided to go even crazier with the house cleaning because I am doing a full music studio remodel. Hasn't quite finished yet, which is why I'm super anxious. And maybe I'll talk about it once it's actually done, but that'll be for another time. I know I shared some pictures of it with you guys. Alex, did you have any particular feelings when you saw the pictures of what was my home studio?
Oh, just the usual sheer jealousy that I have with pretty much everything that you do, Vince. I mean, you just business as usual, really. No, I'm very envious. I'm one of those kinds of people who, I understand the importance of a comfortable work environment. And whenever I look at sort of pictures of other people's, work studio setups and stuff, I'm always extremely curious to check out what other people do with their studio setup and look at like the ergonomics and the convenience and the pragmatism and just the, you know, the style and all of that. But then when it comes to my own setup, it's pretty primitive. Let's just say the phrase, "this is where the magic happens," is one that I use quite a lot when people come over, because it's sort of the disclaimer about how bare bones my surroundings are. You know, actually, it would be really great if you could keep us up to date here on the show about the progress with your build, because, it's an exciting step, I think, for a lot of people. It's a step that evidently I haven't taken yet, but it's an exciting step for a lot of people in having a reason and the budget and the time to invest in a nice room environment for doing their work in. Mm-hmm. I'm for one really, really eager to hear about, you know, the various kind of problems that pop up as you're going through this process, and sort of the decisions, what kind of acoustic paneling, where to put the speakers, what to do about the dreaded problem of multiple monitors if you have like a near field speaker setup, because often like with near fields, to form that triangle with your head, you don't mm-hmm. really have enough space to put two monitors next to each other. So there's that problem that we all deal with. So yeah, I would be really eager to hear about how things are going.
Yeah, I would be glad to update you guys on that. But actually, I've been kind of thinking about this because even though my home studio is currently in that state, so I had shared some pictures with Alex and Mike of, oh, no more walls. You could just see the studs and the electrical wiring and no floor and all that. So I'm obviously not working there. But I had to continue working. Actually, a friend of mine said, hey, can you do some short order music work for us? Like, quick, 48 hours, 72 hours sort of turnaround type thing. I'm like, sure. I do have my computer and I will just move it to a bedroom and let's just set up my computer again. So right now I'm kind of just sort of jammed in here with the bed and everything else, because this needs to be a functional bedroom. It's mostly a functional bedroom for when my dad or my sister comes over, and they will probably in a couple weeks. But I just shoved my stuff in here and started working on this. I don't have a lot of my outboard stuff set up. And whatever, I just got to put some music out there and hopefully they like it. Seems like they like it, so that's good. But it does make me wonder about, wow, I'm spending time and money and energy and a lot of frustration as we're sort of moving things around in order to get this ideal home music studio production setup working. And at least in this case, I was able to pull off this job pretty quickly, pretty easily with basically just what's in my computer. Maybe I'm going about this all wrong and just putting too much energy and too much money into what is ostensibly my career, but I don't know.
Did you move your primary music machine into another room, or did you do work on a secondary computer?
Oh, I moved my machine. So I've really struggled with doing music on laptops for various reasons. So this Mac Pro that I actually got earlier this year is my one music production machine. So I just moved it into this bedroom and set up my computer, set up the desk. I got to have a MIDI keyboard. Let's go. You know, I'm not recording anything. I'm not doing any outboard gear stuff. I'm just doing everything in the box. And well, you know, this type of music works pretty well. And I actually shared some music with these guys just a few minutes ago. It's pretty straightforward stuff, sort of hard rocking synth, electric guitar, drums, you know, stuff that we can do really easily in the box. And what am I doing spending all this time and money just waiting for this ideal music studio to actually show up? Are things really going to change once that happens? Because if it's just a matter of efficiency and working quickly, at least so far I've been able to show that I can do that with just my computer. You know, I really do sometimes question these purchases and these investments that I've made. So I know I've seen Alex's setup quite a few times in videos, but Mike, I think your setup is a little bit hazy in my mind since you tend to move around when you're recording this podcast. Well, what's your setup currently looking like?
I've got what at one point in the distant past, before I moved into this house, was, I assume, a garage, and that someone, the prior resident, changed into an office space. So there's no garage door. There's just a normal door. So they really did a substantial conversion of it. And it works fairly well for most purposes. It's larger than I need. The floor has some built-in carpet to it. Walls and ceiling are not super. It's the typical Los Angeles flaky popcorn type ceiling. Which I guess in its defense at least is an irregular surface, so there's some breaking up of sound waves, I imagine. There is some storage closets, which I have filled with boxes, both for utilitarian box reasons, but also because they're cardboard and they do well for sound absorption and diffusion. It's more space than I need most of the time, but I could, and I've only recorded one musician at a time, I think, maybe two or three. But it's much more space than I normally use. The big downside is that because it's a converted garage, there isn't anything by way of climate control. So at climate extremes, or such climate extremes as exist in Los Angeles, it can get a little hot or get a little cold. And I've developed various workarounds for it. But it's comfy. It leaves me room to have a in sort of perpendicular to my main desk, I've got a secondary digital piano that serves as the old-timey scoring station. So I've got a big board on an angle that I can lean scoring paper on and just do the old composer at a piano with a pencil thing. And if I swivel 90 degrees to the left, I'm back at my computer and my normal setup. So it gives me certain advantages in that I can choose different kinds of work modalities depending on what I'm doing.
Do you have that acoustic treatment set up?
Yeah, I have your standard Oralex on the walls, which do the job for most purposes. You know, it's not an anechoic chamber by any means, but it's quiet enough for what I need to do. And on such occasions that I've recorded, the main noise issue has actually been the fans of hard drives and not the room's acoustics. So as someone who works primarily in a kind of digital recording composing modality, and you know, when I record live human musicians, I go somewhere else, I'm fairly well served by the level of noise that I have to deal with.
That's cool.
That's really cool. I am a little bit jealous of that whole thing of the different modalities. You know, that image, it's such a romantic image, really, of the composer sitting at the piano with his notes. And I think, I want to be that. I think it would be really cool to be that. But then also coming to grips with the fact that I haven't been that in a long, long time, yet I still pine for that. Maybe it's just me. Alex, have you ever felt something like that?
No, I mean, I'm a little bit different because, you know, I'm a bass player. I'm not a pianist. And so for me, yeah, I mean, working out, I need a keyboard in order to sort of work out chords and things like that. But a lot of the times I'm just pulling out the bass to obviously make bass lines and melodies and things like that. And so because my keyboard is my main input device for the DAW, therefore I'm at my computer most of the time. So sitting at a piano with some manuscript and a pencil and an eraser, unfortunately, I kind of wish it was, but unfortunately isn't really part of my usual MO, I'm afraid. But Vince, what are you doing as far as acoustic treatment in your new studio?
So the idea is that we're going to have a big fabric wall stretch system that will basically reduce the size of the room by 4 inches on every wall. So wow. It's going to be really, really thick, really controlled. It was a combination of that plus all the other stuff that's going on. You know, we tore down the walls in order to fill that up with more layers of stuff. So rock wool insulation, green glue between layers, cork board, and other layers before we actually put in the drywall and paint. So there's a lot of layers to keep sound out. And then that big 4-inch thick stretch fabric acoustic treatment for just general sound absorption all around for keeping stuff in and controlled.
When you say we, are you working together with some kind of acoustic specialist or something to do this?
I am. I'm working with this company called Haverstick Designs, and they've been really cool, just sort of doing a lot of stuff in terms of giving me options and, you know, showing me the math behind the designs that they've got and what I'm currently working with, and some ideas about what I can do in terms of my equipment as well. Like, you know, things like desks, for example. It's hard to just test out lots and lots of different desks, but these guys know about a lot of desks and can tell me things like, if you have this equipment and you're trying to fit this on the desktop, then it's not going to fit unless you have these particular desks that I know guys have worked with. So,
right.
You know, that's pretty useful stuff there. But, you know, besides that minutia, like the overall design, you know, instead of going back and forth on what the actual design of the room will be in terms of sound, in terms of aesthetics and workflow and storage and all that.
Cool. Actually, this is a little bit of a segue into a topic that I wanted to discuss with you both today. My own setup, I'm on a cliff edge. The next step to upgrade this setup is a big, big one. It's not necessarily one that is needed or is essential. It's more like, you know, if you walked in here today and said, so what would I do to improve this setup? The things that I want would all immediately necessitate a whole bunch of extra stuff that I would have to have in order to facilitate that. So, you know, I, and this is the segue part, but I would like to have a weighted key keyboard, which is, you know, big, obviously, and just a whole lot more fun to play. But my it won't fit on my table. Okay, so therefore, I either put it, like Mike does, perpendicular to my main table, in which case I need somewhere to put my my four lovely relics of the 90s Rompler past here, my JV1080 and the D110 and the MKS50 and the TX81Z, TX81Z in Fahrenheit parlance there. but the in order for this rack mount synths to go somewhere else, it would make sense for them to go into a desk because I'd like to have them in front of me in that case. Then I'd need to upgrade the desk. And then also, if I'm going to upgrade the desk and if I'm going to upgrade the keyboard, I'm also thinking that, well, maybe instead of just like a weighted controller keyboard, why not get something like a really big synth, some kind of big hardware? Well, in that case, I'm obviously going to need my Focusrite interface is maxed out at the moment with these synths. So then I'm going to need like a patch bay or something and a new interface. So basically what went from a new controller keyboard went to a desk, a big synth, a patch bay, and a new interface. So it's like a huge, huge next step. But yeah, actually the topic that I was thinking to discuss wasn't that, but it was actually like 88 key weighted keyboard synthesizers. When you're talking in that kind of echelon, you're basically talking about the big flagship synths from the companies, right? So we're talking
like
about
a big Roland Phantom or something.
Yes, the Roland Phantom, or as is timely for this topic, Yamaha's recently announced their new generation of their Montage line. And for those who don't know, I guess these synthesizers are what you term as workstation synths, because they how would you describe a workstation synth? Because it's interesting, you have, you know, the synthesizer, like a Rompler style big synthesizer, then you've got a workstation, and then you've also got this kind of somewhat more lower lying genre of synthesizers called the arranger keyboard. An arranger keyboard's the line between an arranger keyboard and a workstation synth is a little bit blurred, but basically arranger keyboards are ones that contain just like, you know, hundreds upon hundreds of pre-sequenced accompaniments and things, and they're very, very handy for performers who are kind of one person bands in situations like live performance at venues or things like that. So arranger keyboards. But a workstation synth, they've always intrigued me because they're kind of, you know, they're the top of the line synth for a lot of these Japanese companies especially. But I've always wondered, like, if you have a full DAW setup, you've got a controller keyboard, you've got maybe a few external modules, how does a workstation synth fit into that? Do either of you have one, or have you used one of these like big top of the line flagships?
I think the history of these synthesizers goes back to before DAWs were common, possibly before they really existed. So I think the idea, both of you feel free to jump in and correct anything I say on this topic, but I think the idea is that these keyboards are self-contained. So they have some rudimentary DAW built into them that you access through the small little like 3-inch panel monitor that's embedded into the keyboard. And you can take this thing on the road and in theory not need anything else. Mm. I think early iterations would have floppy drives as a built-in storage medium. And this, you know, arose back when that was how you made music, right? You know, like if you're a new age band in the 80s, that might be the best way to handle that sort of thing, especially if you're going on the road. And that latter use, I think, is how these workstations, I suspect, are used today as really very portable, self-contained audio systems, primarily for live performance, where you need something that's ultra reliable, but still allows you to, say, set up banks of different patch settings for different songs and to jump between them quickly and reliably. So like maybe your band has, song number one has synth strings, then you've got a bass in the left hand. So you set up the key split and you set up the patches, and that's your preset for song number one. And you might configure the keyboard to respond differently to other things. And then maybe there's some kind of pre-baked sequence that you need to trigger for another song. I think that's where these keyboards are at least intended to operate. In modern times, I think the archetype of the laptop sitting on top of a keyboard is probably as common as the more traditional use, but clearly the more traditional use is popular, at least for situations where simplicity and reliability are more important than the unlimited flexibility of a DAW on a laptop.
Yeah, for sure. I would say, what would be the earliest example that you can remember? The one that comes to mind is the Korg M1, but I don't think that the M1 had a sequencer, did it, Vince? Do you remember?
I don't think it did. I mean, I definitely had some experience with the, well, mostly the M1R, but
right.
The M1, did it have a sequencer?
I don't think it did. I'm trying to remember, but that was the first. I remember that. You know, because I've always been a huge fan of synthesizers right from ever since I can remember, and following through the development, there was a magazine that I have all of the issues from issue 2, called Future Music Magazine, from a UK publisher called Future Publishing, and yes, I other than issue 1, I had from issue 2 until, I don't know, whenever I stopped collecting, it was like 60 something. And yeah, so I'd always be following through the '90s, the development of synthesizer technology, and the Korg M1, along with, because the Korg M1 predated the JV-1080, I think, which, and the JV-1080 was sort of the last swan song of the whole JV series. I shouldn't say that, because it was a 2080, a 3080, and I think that went into the whatever. Maybe it was a Phantom. I can't remember now. Anyway. I don't remember which would have been the first synthesizer that had like a built-in sequencer together with all of the sound generation stuff. I think you're probably right, Mike, that I think that perhaps the whole concept of the workstation synth is maybe I wouldn't say a remnant, but their existence is certainly the continued existence is certainly pretty fascinating, considering everything that can be done within a computer these days. It's sort of timely because this week I finally pulled the trigger and caved in, I should say, and bought Falcon by UVI. Have either of you had experience with... I know both of you are contact people, but have you had experience with Falcon?
A little bit. I actually remember using it a bit a while back, because I had some UVI libraries, like some of those Motu things, like a Motu Symphonic Instrument and whatnot, and I had some ability to play around with some of those things, I haven't played around with Falcon in many, many years. I want to say like 5 or 6 years. It's been a while.
How about you, Mike? Have you ever used Falcon? Or do you own it?
I think I downloaded it because the player is free, right? It's kind of akin to the right. Contact player. So I think I toyed around with it a little bit and decided this doesn't offer anything that Contact doesn't.
Right, right. Yeah, actually, they are very, very different, Contact and Falcon, because Falcon is probably what is a main contender that you would have for the workstation killer. Because it's not only, unlike Contact, which is sample-based, Falcon is sample-based as well, but it also has a synth engine inside of it that can do like all of your subtractive and additive and wave table and granular and all that kind of stuff. They're all actual, you know, like algorithmic engines inside Falcon that can do that. And it also has a sequencer built into it as well as all of these kinds of cool, you know, like Euclidean this and, you know, I don't know. There's lots of other fancy words for that. Is it, I can't remember. There's another one, isn't there? Like those kinds of, what do you call them?
rhythmic. Those like funny math, very mathy, rhythmic sort of, rhythm generators. Yeah.
Yeah. So all of that exists inside Falcon as well. So it really is just like one of these workstation synths that has the sample-based Rompler style sound generation, as well as, for example, in the case of Yamaha's recently announced Montage, that's also got their FM engine and their like virtual analog engine and wavetables and all this kind of stuff. Falcon, I bought it because UVI has a, I don't know, they have a, they seem to have a knack at releasing sound libraries that just really tickle my interest. It's just, you know, I each time they make an announcement, it's like, ooh, that's nice. Like, oh, I'd really like to have that. For example, the first one that they did was their Fairlight, CMI Fairlight library called the Dark Light. I mean, come on, guys, you've got to have a Fairlight library. Everybody has to have a Fairlight library. For all of the you know, the Kate Bush moments or the Peter Gabriel moments, you know, we got to have a Fairlight. They've also got an excellent collection of electric pianos, like an electric piano, electric keyboard library, which contains the Wurlitzers and the Rhodes and the Yamaha stage pianos and, you know, a whole bunch of other interesting things, as well as lots of very unusual kind of 80s and 90s kind of more eclectic synths as well. They tend to do libraries for them. That's very, very much my wheelhouse. So anyway, I purchased Falcon, and that was only on like Thursday or Friday at a sale. And I haven't really had a chance to really dig that deep into it yet. But it got me really thinking that this kind of big, massive kind of workstation approach in the DAW makes a lot of sense. But as an external keyboard, I don't know, like really, if I was going to, you know, put a lot of money into a 88 key weighted keyboard controller, is it even worth considering something like a Montage for game audio? Or, you know, if I have all of the stuff in the box anyway, does it really not present that much of an advantage to our craft? I mean, what would you both say if somebody said, you know, I'm thinking to get into game audio and I don't know what I need, but hey, this Yamaha Montage, you know, it's Yamaha's best synthesizer. Is that enough for me? You know, what would you say?
Oh man, there's so much there. One thought was, you know, a person that's looking to get their first car. You know, they get their driver's license. They're at point A. They want to go to point B and point C. They're like, oh man, Bentley just released a new car, or you know, or Koenigsegg released a new car. Like, I feel like a lot of, you know, not exactly perfectly apt, at least in terms of the market, but I think in terms of the technology, there's a lot of that there, where, you know, BMW makes a 7 Series sedan, and most people are not spending $100,000 on a luxury car new, but those are still interesting because those are the things that will trickle down into a 5 Series, a 3 Series, a 1 Series BMW car the next year and the year after that. And like with the Roland Phantom, which I'm a little more familiar with just because I'm kind of a Roland fanboy, but also with the Yamaha Montage M, this has everything. Like, it's not just the workstation, it's not just the synth engines, it's not just the keyboard, it's everything together. So, like, in terms of their controller, like, that keybed on that Montage M8X is their premier keybed. Their synthesizers in there, or at least the multiple synth engines that they've got in there, because they've got the combination of the AWM engine, which is basically their sample-based, classic sample-based playback, the FMX engine, and then the ANX engine. So FMX is, of course, FM synth, you know, I think it's 8 operator FM synth and programming for that. And then ANX, which is their analog synth engine, and being able to manage all of that at the same time and have patches access all of that. Like, this really does seem like a place for power users to just get really, really excited about what they can do with samples and FM and analog all together and create something that is just absolutely awesome. And seeing what that particular interface and that keyboard is able to allow people to create, and like, that'll be cool. Like, that person who is just getting their foot in the door in terms of sound design or music composition or music production, you know, this type of thing is overwhelming, just like someone getting into the, you know, behind the wheel of a Ferrari for the first time.
Right. I mean, by extension, does that mean that, you know, if it's not such a good choice for people just starting out? And also, okay, so what is a good choice for people just starting out? Well, maybe like a MIDI controller keyboard, you know, a relatively more a modest spec one, and, you know, one of the big big name DAWs with that comes with a lot of built-in libraries and stuff that you might need when you're just beginning. So, for example, like Cubase or Logic or
GarageBand.
Well, I guess GarageBand. Indeed. If that's a good place to start off. And then, of course, if you're based in the DAW when you begin, then you're probably going to start to buy other plugins, other VST or software instruments to go with that. At which point, mid-tier, when you're at the midpoint of your career, is it even then a useful tool to have one of these workstations? Or, like, really, from what you're saying, Vince, fundamentally, by extension, just like a Lamborghini or a Koenigsegg or a Bugatti or whatever, these aren't really pragmatic vehicle choices for the majority of us drivers on the road. Can it also be said that this kind of workstation synth, especially for us working game audio people, is also not really a very pragmatic choice at any point in a career? What do you think about that?
You know, as much as the pragmatic side thinks, oh yeah, of course, yeah, you don't really need this thing, there is also the fact that we are musicians, and musicians develop a relationship with their instrument, and whatever is necessary in order to maintain and foster that relationship, I think is important. I mean, I'm a pianist. I could get by on a little Wurlitzer Spinet. I did for many, many years when I was growing up. But, you know, I decided to get a really nice grand piano because part of being a musician means maintaining that relationship with my instrument so that I can be the best musician that I can. And I think also, these Montages and Phantoms and other keyboards that are out there, whether they be the top of the line workstation or maybe something a little bit, you know, further down, you know, you don't have to get a $5,000 keyboard. You can certainly get a $3,000 keyboard or a $2,000 keyboard, but whatever. I think it is really important that you actually love that instrument. But maybe that's me, since I did grow up as a pianist, and it was actually relatively late that I decided to move over to being a composer. What about you, Mike?
Well, I think that there isn't a functionality argument for these workstation keyboards, because literally everything they do can be found elsewhere and can be instantiated in a DAW. But there might be I'm drawing from what both of you said, I think there might be a workflow argument for certain people, where if you want a minimalist sequencer that gives you quick results for simple things, and you just want one, for lack of a smarter term, object that you're using to make music and don't want a more complex system, and for whatever reason that taps into your creative process more effectively, then there could be an argument for getting a workstation like this. There's also the live performance application where you just want fewer points of failure and you want something that's maximally reliable and simple. We discussed that earlier, but even for people who are not in the trenches of live performance, there is something to be said for a simple physical hardware interface for a lot of functionalities. I don't think I've experienced this myself. Like, I've never gotten comfortable enough with a workstation keyboard to really want to use one, but I have used some of the Rompler boxes that you, Alex, you alluded to earlier. And I remember when I was just starting out, I just had I didn't really have any software-based sample libraries. I just have my Rompler boxes. So that's kind of an approximation of the same thing, right? You've got a physical box, a limited menu, a dial, and some buttons. And I found that my creative process was very accelerated within the very small, narrow sandbox of what was possible. So I can, by extrapolation, imagine using one of these monster Goliath workstations that have the entire music production universe packed into a keyboard form factor, how you might also enter that workflow where you just like using this thing to do everything. Yeah, that's a lot of conjecture, but that's what I think on that topic.
Yeah, I think if you are a very, very skilled and virtuosic keyboard player, then I can definitely see how, you know, a workstation keyboard actually, as you said, could remove a lot of those distractions, could take away some of the, you know, the choice paralysis that we often have with all these tools in the box. And as I said, if you have that skill at playing a keyboard, then yeah, why not? If you have a workstation sequencer and you just hit record and you can start actually playing the parts in and then quantize them inside the workstation and then just start layering things up like that by actually playing along with yourself, then it could be a really, really efficient workflow. Like somebody like Vince perhaps could benefit from something like that because Vince, you're such an amazing keyboard player. However, if you're not a keyboard player like me, then it actually is the opposite. You know, it's far more ergonomic for me to be, you know, punching in notes in Renoise in a tracker, in my case, or maybe like, you know, squinting at a piano roll and dragging up bars and stuff like that in this ridiculous piano roll paradigm. I don't know, these modern day tools. Anyway, if you're not a keyboard player, then actually sort of manually entering your notes that way or like step input or things like that, maybe these workstation keyboards are so incredibly well designed now that, you know, there is some form of manual note entry that is extremely efficient on them, more so than pointing and clicking on a piano roll or typing stuff in on a tracker listing or whatever. I mean, actually, who does that really? Seriously, it's only me really, I think, but anyway,
hey, you'd be surprised. Yeah.
I think it's probably the whether or not you're I mean, that's part of the reason why I still enjoy tracker interfaces is because I'm not a keyboard player and I don't play keyboard very well. Therefore, I'm always manually entering stuff. So if I'm manually entering with a mouse versus with a QWERTY keyboard in a listing, which can be much faster in that case, you know, and that's that reason. So I think it comes back to really, are you a pianist? If you are, how do you feel about computers? Do you find that using a computer is kind of somehow a barrier to efficiency and productivity for you? In that case, yeah, potentially one of these big flagship synthesizers, workstations, I should say, potentially one of these could be a really fun choice for you.
Oh, man, there's some other things going on with this montage that are really interesting. So, apparently, Yamaha has a new keyboard that's specifically on the high-end Montage M8X. And besides being a more realistic, fully weighted keyboard, it also has polyphonic aftertouch. Mm. So you don't really see that everywhere. There are definitely keyboards out there that have aftertouch, but that's aftertouch on the whole keybed. It won't do it to one note out of whatever, but this is polyphonic aftertouch. So you could be playing like a whole chord underneath and in your right hand and then on your pinky. You're doing that thing that so many pianists will still do. Well, they're like sort of vibrate their finger on the ivory as if it could do something to the sound. But of course it doesn't because the hammer's already well away from the piano strings. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so there's that. There's the fact that it's also in a 6-in 32 output audio interface. Yeah. So, you know, you don't necessarily need like another high end sound interface. You could just use this as your audio interface.
Hold on. How many outputs did you say? 32?
32.
Six in and 32 out. That is fantastic. Like, just, I'm trying to think, like, how, yeah, that's. Can you just imagine the board meeting at Yamaha HQ with, how many outputs do you think we should put on this? Two? Nah, well, let's go 32. Why not?
Well, it makes sense, though, because for live performance, you know, everyone is doing more and more stuff when it comes to live performance. And yeah, let's give lots of things to the board mixer to deal with for, you know, for anything. It could be your rock show. It could be your, you know, house of worship, because, like, you know, that is just so big these days, where you have to have like a full show, and you're doing much more stuff with immersive sound for a large audience there. So the 32 right. output actually feels very, very natural to me. Like, I could see people going right to this, say, yes, that's exactly what I want. And I can have that much control, and like, okay, let me just switch patches, or I'll split my keyboard, and this stuff is going to go to another output in the hall, in the back of the hall. So there's that. But also, this thing is actually really interesting. Expanded soft synth plugin, and it's not there yet, because this Montage that we're talking about, it's already on the market, but coming early 2024 is the expanded soft synth plugin, which replicates the Montage M in your favorite DAW. So it's free for all registered Montage M owners. The expanded soft synth plugin, or ESP, as they call it, and I don't think they're referring to the guitar, allows you to create, edit, and mix Montage M performances anywhere you happen to be without the hardware. So they have the full audio guts of the Montage working in a plugin.
Now that is cool. That is really cool. Actually, I wonder how much that plugin costs.
Free for Montage M owners, but they don't share anything else besides that.
No, that's that is cool, and I think it's got 400 note polyphony.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's 400. Man, I remember the days when, like, you know, 32 note polyphony was like, whoa, 32, wow, you know. And I think what is it? Yeah, I'm just looking across to my JV1080. It says 64 voice. I remember it's like, wow, 64. Like, we've only got 10 fingers.
I think the way these usually work is that each patch can be multiple voices, depending on how they define a patch. So conceivably, you know, you're holding down as a triad, but if each of your fingers is responsible for four of what that synth considers a voice, you can burn through your polyphony pretty quickly.
Yeah, also, if you're holding a pedal down and then you just got sustained notes, then, yeah, the more voices of polyphony, the better. Yeah. Man, 400 though. I mean, that is this, like, part of me just as a monument, like a this kind of shining monument to the history of synthesizer technology development. Part of me just thinks, yeah, I just want to have one. Of course, I'm not going to get one, and there's no way. And they're very, very, very expensive.
I mean, yeah,
but just like, as yeah, like I said, like a this shining model of this achievement of that all we've all the progress that we've made in synthesizer technology up to this point, this thing kind of represents all of that. It's amazing.
Yeah, you know, it's not that expensive. I mean, you could get a nice used car, or you can get a Yamaha Montage M8X. All right,
a used Koenigsegg or a Lamborghini or.
Hey, let's go back to what you were talking about with this weighted keyboard. I mean, because have you figured out what weighted keyboard you're going to get?
No. I mean, the big thing is that as a non-keyboard player, like, I don't play, I can play keyboard, I can string together chords and you know, play a little bit, enough to kind of compose music, basically. I can't perform on a keyboard. So really, that means, number one, I don't really need 88 keys or like a full piano register range. I don't need that. Number two, really all it is only, it's purely ergonomics, because when you're, you know, playing on a weighted keyboard, even if you don't play keyboards, if you're playing on a piano or a nicely weighted, you know, synthesizer keyboard or controller keyboard, it's just so much more fun. You know, the keys bounce a bit, there's a bit of momentum there, and you just kind of, yeah, it's just so much more fun to play. But not needing 88 keys really means, yeah, like just in terms of space and in terms of actual practical everyday use, I would only really be using maybe 3 or 4 octaves in the middle of that. So like, and there's just this eternal gap in the market for weighted keyboard controllers that have less than 88 keys. Like I would love like a 4-octave weighted keyboard. And it seems like keyboard manufacturers just assume that, well, yeah, if you want a weighted keyboard as opposed to a synthesizer keyboard action, that means you're a pianist, therefore you want 88 keys. But I would love for somebody to realize that, well, no, actually, you know, if you don't have to be a pianist to appreciate a weighted key and what it can do just for the fun of playing a keyboard. And then in my case, yeah, I certainly don't need that much. And if, and just from the desk that I have and the room that I have in my studio here, I would love to have a smaller form factor with weighted keys. But there just doesn't seem to be a model out there, which is, you know, like a, what's this, 49 key is what I'm looking at the moment.
Yeah.
Which is my, like that's, a 49 key.
I think one of the big things is that when you have the weighted key mechanism, that's automatically going to add more space. So I think that on a 40, you know, if you have like a 49 key keyboard, it might end up looking kind of ridiculous. It's almost like a square rather than a rectangle, just because the extra mechanism there.
True, yeah, but I mean, it wouldn't look any more ridiculous than any other 49 key synthesizer, right? Because most of the synthesizers will be around 49 or slightly above.
Right.
I mean, it probably the depth. Yes, you're right. Like the depth of it would because you need to have a bit more depth in order to have all that action at the back. But I don't know. They're just not out there, and I guess there clearly isn't a market for it because somebody would have done it by now. I really don't need 88 keys, but I really want to have a weighted action. So anyone from Roland or Yamaha, if you're listening to this, go and make it, please, and I'll buy it.
Well, you'll sell one. Oh, you've got a circular saw.
That's right. Get the 88
Alex,
keys.
So your keyboard, on what surface does it sit currently?
Currently it sits on right in the middle of my table. So I have the QWERTY keyboard right in front of me, and then behind that is the MIDI keyboard, and then behind that is the monitor, and then I have my speakers up on stands. And I have two monitors, one right in front, and then I have my secondary monitor right off to the right side. So my speakers I'm only looking at one monitor in front of me because it's a relatively shallow desk. So yeah, if I were to get any kind of weighted keyboard, it would not fit on the table. I would have to put it perpendicular to the table. Or if I had like some kind of larger desk, then I suppose I would try and find some kind of system where it could be on a tray or something like that on top of my lap.
Here's one ergonomic consideration that I happen to be obsessed with myself that may or may not apply to your situation, depending on whether or not you put it on the desk, as you say, or if you put it on a 90-degree angle on a supplementary desk. But weighted keyboards push because they need this physical mechanism, the height of the physical keys is almost always higher than on a non-weighted keyboard. So if you think of the ergonomics of accessing that keyboard, be prepared for your hand to be higher in the air while playing, which may or may not present a comfort issue. This is why I always use really low-end non-weighted keyboards, and it's not because I'm in love with them, but because I can't deal with the keys being any higher than they currently are. That's a handy tip for anyone thinking about making that jump.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. And I don't really play the keyboard for more than, you know, a few minutes at a time because I don't play keyboard. So it's not like I'm practicing scales or trying to play whole pieces on the keyboard that's in front of me. But yeah, I know what you mean by the height, and I don't think that a weighted keyboard wouldn't fit on my table anyway. Actually, Vince, I wanted to ask a pianist, have you ever tried mini keys? you know, a lot of the like the Yamaha Reface series.
Oh gosh.
Okay, I guess you have. I think your answer.
They're so difficult to play with. I have such trouble with it because I like to spread my hands out, and I do have slightly larger than usual hands, so it feels like so difficult to play. It's not my favorite.
Okay. Yeah, because I've apparently, as far as mini keys go, Yamaha's Reface mini series of mini keyboards, as far as mini keys go, apparently they're quite nice, I guess, apparently. I've never tried one in a store or anything, so I don't really know. Just in terms of how they feel for like a mini key size synthesizer action, apparently they're pretty good. And the Yamaha DX, of course, is, very much in terms of sound, very much in my wheelhouse again. So that's been another thing. It's like, well, maybe instead of like this controller that I've got, if I'm just going to have to get another controller, and as Mike said, you know, if it's just going to go on the desk in front of me so that I don't have this big discrepancy between the height of like my keyboard and my mouse and the controller keyboard, then maybe looking at some kind of synthesizer option, and then something small like the DX, which I think they have three octaves, I think, on those. Again, you know, if I'm not because I'm not a pianist, you know, maybe that could be an option. I don't know. I'd have to find a shop that stocks them, and they're unfortunately, there aren't too many music shops left in Stockholm because of the ubiquity of Thomann here, which is this big music gear distributor in Germany that kind of covers a monopoly over all of Europe. So it's quite hard to actually go into a store and just try a key bed now, but. Have you ever tried mini keys, Mike? And what do you think of them?
I'm trying to figure out what size you mean. I assume you don't mean like back years ago, a billion years ago, I had like a Casio SK1, their first foray into sampling keyboards, which had like microscopic piano. It was almost like a toy.
It's like the membrane type or something where, not membrane, well, but it's like.
They were physical keys. They weren't pressing down on a membrane, but they were just miniature, like you were looking at your keyboard from across a long room. But I think there's something in between these two extremes that you might be referring to. And I don't know. I just remember, like, when I was a teenager, I had an option of getting keyboards that had not full-sized keys, but I always steered clear, and I don't think I've ever tried one since then.
Okay. Yeah, I have tried one, which was like a Korg micro control, I think it was called, or micro key, nano key, or micro key, one of those two. And I don't know. I just don't really like synthesizer key beds in general. I just find the this quite unsatisfying to play. I like to have the bit of bounce there and the sort of instant return underneath your finger. You push it down, you lift up your finger, this kind of organ keybed style. I just don't really like it. So I think I'd be pretty dissatisfied with everything unless it's weighted, in which case maybe I just get mini keys and be done with it. save the desk space and play some nice Yamaha DX7 e-piano or some Enya or something like that and be done with it. Anyway, yes, These are the conundrums that we all deal with, I guess.
You know, it's been a while since I've had a hammer, you know, fully weighted type of keyboard connected to my computer. I've been dealing with semi-weighted for so long.
Oh, and wait, really? Really? Oh, okay. Hold on. What exactly is what's the difference between fully weighted and semi-weighted in terms of feel?
Let's see. Quite honestly, I feel like semi-weighted is pretty good for me because, yeah, they are lighter keys. They're easy to play. They're fine. There is no mechanism there for the key to actually come up and bounce back at you with some more energy than what you might have given it. But it's perfectly fine. I think the reason why I was so put off by fully weighted actions is that at the low end, there are a lot of bad ones out there.
Oh, okay.
And I realized that a bad weighted keyboard is so bad. you know, most fully weighted keyboards out there are going to be a little more expensive, you know, $1,000, $2,000 for what's just basically a keyboard controller or, you know, a piano versus right. your workstations or whatever to have like a bunch of synths and sound design controls and whatnot. You know, that's not too crazy. For a long time, I was looking at these cheaper fully weighted keyboards that would come out at $200, $400, $500. And I thought, oh, okay, it's a weighted keyboard. It should be inherently better than a semi-weighted keyboard. And it's not. It's so bad. You know, the thing is, there are a lot of elements of a grand piano action that companies can choose to emulate or decide, oh, no, we can't do that. And sometimes they decide not to do certain things. That's fine. For example, the whole grand piano escapement, where there's going to be part of the key that actually doesn't really drive any energy to the hammer that strikes the string, but you could still like push down on the key and have that feel there. You know, how important is that? You know, not really. But if you drive into it with a certain amount of energy and you hear that and you feel that bounce back, it's great. A couple years back, I was trying out some of these keyboards from some of these cheaper manufacturers like M Audio. Let's just go ahead and say it. You know, they definitely made a lot of different fully weighted keyboards in the under $500 range. They were all really, really bad. What they had as a fully weighted action was just a heavy and unrealistic action that was just very tiresome as opposed to being really fun to play.
Okay.
So yeah, that's something that I decided to, you know, go away from. And, you know, with a lot of these keyboards, you know, semi-weighted actions from reputable keyboard manufacturers, of which there are many. I'm not sure M Audio is one of them. Sorry. but they're pretty good. They're pretty consistent. They're easy to play. I don't get tired when I play them. You know, so I've been using semi-weighted keyboards for a while now.
I don't know whether it's semi-weighted or fully weighted, but the best keyboard action that I've ever tried that wasn't a real piano was actually when we used to live in Japan. We had the lowest model of Yamaha kind of home electric piano. You know, they have this whole series of sort of home pianos where it'll be like basically just a keyboard with like eight sounds on it. You know, you have like
two, a P series or something.
Yeah, exactly. It was a P. It was P34 or something. I don't forget the number. But I remember we bought it because I saw that Yamaha actually has the same keybed in all of their P-series keyboards from the very, very low end right up to the top end. But on the low end, you just only get like eight sounds and some kind of more crappy speakers or something like that. Whereas the high end gives you better speakers and more sounds and more maybe some more functionality like recording yourself playing or a metronome or stuff like that. So we just had the very, very lowest end, the lowest model. Man, the action on that was just glorious. And I remember that I say that I'm not a pianist and I'm not a keyboard player, but whenever I would play that, it would always be like, man, I sound pretty good. I can do this. I can play this. I can play piano pretty good. And that was kind of what has given me this notion that if I had a weighted keyboard, I would just, it would just be so much more inspiring to play like that Yamaha was. I don't know if that was semi-weighted or fully weighted, but
oh, those are fully weighted. All those Yamaha P series, those are great actions. Like they're definitely done to a price point, you know, because you can get all those lower end Yamaha P series digital pianos for, you know, under $1,000 or like maybe even closer to $500. But they are actually really good actions. They have, as far as I know, I don't think they have ever made a clunker in that P series line, whether it be the more expensive ones or the cheaper ones, because they really do care about piano feel.
Yeah, I mean, Yamaha kind of has a little bit of a reputation to uphold because they make actual pianos as well. So, if you're buying a Yamaha, then you would probably have certain expectations about the quality of the key bed, regardless of the price tier that you're buying at. But that's the, in terms of like, you know, which of these weighted keyboards that I've been looking at, actually one of these lower end Yamaha P series, just because of that excellent experience we had with the one in Japan, is top on my list because it is affordable. Unfortunately, being a home keyboard and not a MIDI controller means that you don't get any, you know, rotary knobs or like a pitch bend wheel or a modulation wheel, which is a big problem. And I'd have to like buy like some kind of other solution to deal with that, which is a little bit off-putting. So, yeah, anyway. Well, this has turned into a bit of a gear and more gear episode, hasn't it? We usually try to avoid these, but I guess every now from time to time, it's a healthy thing, I suppose.
I mean, it's also okay. Mostly
it's gear that we don't use, which is the opposite of what gear sessions tend to be.
Yeah, whoops. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Hey, you never know. I might go for that Yamaha Montage. I mean, there's a lot of people I know that are just clamoring for that thing. They think that it's going to be super exciting, and I certainly don't begrudge them for that because, you know, the sound design possibilities seem really cool. That whole thing with the sample bass plus the FM bass plus the new analog engine is actually kind of exciting if you're a real power user sound designer. So that's really cool.
Yeah, or you just get UVI Falcom, which is the same thing. Exactly the same.
Yeah, but I know right now it's on sale, but it's going to stop being on sale in a few hours, so it doesn't help people who are listening to this podcast right now. Sorry, guys.
Right. Just one last question on the Montage. I presume that the weighted keyboard versions of that, that's going to be, you already mentioned, didn't you, that that's like Yamaha's top-of-the-line weighted keyboard mechanism, is it?
It is. So the cheaper ones, the slightly cheaper ones, the M6 and the M7, they have their last generation but still highest end version of that keybed.
Okay.
But the new M8X apparently is a brand new keybed that they made just for this one.
Wow. Okay. Well,
so that's exciting. I would love to get my hands on it, maybe at one of these NAMM shows, which are going to come around in a few months. Maybe that will happen.
That'd be great to hear your impressions of it if you actually get to try one out.
Yeah, I would love to. Hey, you should join us for a NAMM show at some point. Yay, you should come over to LA.
Speaking of going to LA, we have Game SoundCon coming up this week. Well, I guess it'll be last week by the time that this episode goes out. Yeah, I'm going to be participating as much as I can remotely. I have bought a ticket and plan to tune into some of the lectures in the evening here in Europe. So that's exciting.
Yeah, I think it would be really great to get your feedback on what do you think of the online experience and attending those sessions virtually.
Yeah, I did it last time, or actually last time I think I attended virtually. So I'm looking forward to it again this time.
Mike, are you doing Game SoundCon stuff this year?
I might do the remote, likewise. I might do the remote participation, depending on what my workload is and kind of juggling multiple projects at the moment. And I might steal away to one of the social events or one of the, you know, like the gang mixer that they always do or something like that. But despite the extreme convenience, I'm not going to be there in person.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that is cool. That is too bad. Apparently, in-person tickets have actually sold out by virtue of the venue size limitations, but you can still register online for the virtual attendance.
That's right. So, they moved this year, right? They're in the Valley.
Yep. They're in Burbank.
I could walk there. That's how convenient it is. But
hey, well, maybe one of these days, you know, after hours, we can, you know, grab some coffee or something. I'm actually going to be there both days, Tuesday and Wednesday. I'm planning on being there really early in the morning, like around 6:30 on Tuesday, just meeting with people for breakfast and driving up from Orange County. Yeah, that's
wow. Yep. Maybe just get a hotel the night before.
Oh, I like driving. I think I've learned to really love driving, living in Los Angeles, which gives me plenty of time to listen to all sorts of stuff, all sorts of music. So let's get to the last part of the Game Audio Hour, which is conspicuous consumption. Has there been anything that you've been playing or listening to or watching recently that has really tickled your fancy? Alex, have you been consuming anything particularly cool lately?
I have indeed. I finished up with Starfield. And so I finished the main quest last week, I think it was. I think I would describe it as an ocean that's 1 inch deep, unfortunately. I had high expectations for it, but as a big fan of space games in general. But it's a wonderful achievement, but just I think the lack of character animation and the constant loading screens really kind of rob it of any sort of sense of proper immersion that you want with some kind of science fiction-based game like this. So, yeah, a little bit mediocre, I'm afraid to say. But anyway, I moved on from that to Cyberpunk's new 2.0 update and their DLC Phantom Liberty. And unfortunately, the difference between Cyberpunk Phantom Liberty and Starfield could not be more stark. It's like everything that I just said, just the opposite of everything I just said.
Wow.
It's absolutely incredible. And I was a big fan of the original, so I'm very the original Cyberpunk 2077, so I'm very, very biased, but just sensational. And actually, what I have been more interestingly consuming alongside the game is actually Neuromancer by William Gibson, the original novel, of course, where the entire genre of cyberpunk was born. And I'm ashamed to admit, I have owned Neuromancer and Count Zero and Mona Lisa Overdrive for about 2 years. And I've read like the first two chapters of it about 20 times because if anybody who has read William Gibson, you might know, or maybe, you know, maybe I just suck at reading novels perhaps, but like it's very, very dense reading. And the concepts just come at you at just such rapid pace. And Gibson just drops these incredible, very short, concise, heavily loaded descriptive sentences that you really have to be concentrating when you're reading them. Because otherwise, you know, there's all this imagery and incredible world building just zips right by you if you're not on the ball. So as a result, I read it and then, you know, get busy with kids and family stuff. And I come back to read it. It's like, oh, I can't remember what's going on anymore. I have to read it again. So I go over and over and over again. This time, though, I've made a bit better progress and I've actually made time to sort of read it each week on Sundays, usually Sunday evenings. And yeah, wow. I highly, highly recommend it. It's one of these situations, a bit like the original Star Wars movie or, you know, any one of these sort of seminal science fiction works where you sort of, like Tolkien's Lord of the Rings as well in the fantasy genre, you sort of pinch yourself every now and then to remind yourself that this incredible thing was actually the first. It's like, wow, this is really fresh. Like this could have been released yesterday and it would be a smash hit. And then you realize, oh, well, actually, it was written in 1984, published in 1984, and it was the first of this genre. And then you come to realize, yeah, there's that chilling sensation when you realize, yep, this is the beginning of a genre. That's how you do it. That is how you do it. So anyway, William Gibson's Neuromancer, if you are a fan of the sort of dystopian intersection between humans and technology, and you appreciate things like that, then highly recommend it as some not very light reading, but very, very well worth you know, knowing where it all began, so to speak. So that's been me. How about you, Mike?
Well, I will add as a addendum to what you said. I remember reading Neuromancer, and I remember having to reread pages just to fully digest what was being said. And if memory serves, sometimes you were it was because you were in the perspective of a character who was using slang or just giving you kind of a stream of consciousness, and they weren't going out of their way to be super clear. You were right. Living in their head. And it was because of that you had to reread and say, what did they just actually say? Or what's the subtext here? Right. You know, as opposed to Neal Stephenson, who occupies a similar space in terms of futurism and science fiction, but who is much more happy to explain things at length.
Right.
On my end, on the music side of things, every now and then I think of a popular artist and think, what's the deal with person XYZ? So recently I've asked myself, what's the deal with Randy Newman? And how's that for an artist as far as you can get from game audio, except perhaps in the sense that there's probably video games made of the Toy Story franchise. But I was kind of curious, you know, what did he sound like at his peak? And I found the obligatory online list of Randy Newman albums in the order that you should listen to them. So I followed that. And I've been impressed. Honestly, I've been impressed by his early work, the work that put him on the map. And the two albums I would recommend if you want to see what's the deal with Randy Newman are, Sail Away and Little Criminals. And I think the two of them will give you a sense of his blend of kind of New Orleans blues and vaudeville. And I found myself charmed and entertained and kind of into it more than I expected to be. So
I'm somewhat relieved, Mike. For a moment there, I thought you were going to say, what's the deal with Alex May? is the deal with that guy? I don't know either. Anyway.
That would be a very bold topic to introduce on the show. But so it's been fun so far. And I'm actually friends with the official archivist of Randy Newman. So I've asked him for a further listening list. And as you might expect, I got more than I bargained for. But so far, it's been very enjoyable, and I recommend him if you're interested in checking out that kind of 1970s-ish singer-songwriter dude at piano genre to which Billy Joel and Elton John also belong. How about yourself, Vince?
Oh, man, it's funny that you mentioned that. I'm sort of around that same era, or maybe just a little bit after that, but definitely different. I kind of went down a rabbit hole of specifically earliest digitally recorded albums and singles in the late 70s, early 80s.
Wow.
But from there, I actually realized how much I am actually really influenced by yacht rock. Because I am actually very, very influenced by yacht rock, because that's what my dad would sometimes listen to. And I decided to revisit some good old Christopher Cross.
Oh, yes.
And I'm like, yes. Yeah, have you this got is some, actually a good album.
You got some Paul & Oates and Steely Dan in there as well?
Yes, I did have some Steely Dan in there. But actually, lately, I've specifically been listening to the first Christopher Cross album called Christopher Cross, because there's a couple specific tracks in there that are among the very first tracks recorded with the 3M digital recording system.
All right.
There were a lot of things out there that were recorded digitally back then from various people, tape machine guys trying to make that, big electronics companies like Sony. Sony had a 13-bit digital recording system that they used on various classical and jazz albums in the late 70s and early 80s. But in terms of like mainstream success, you'd probably have to point to Christopher Cross and Sailing as being, that is the first big mainstream number one hit digitally recorded song.
That's amazing. That's fascinating. I had no idea. Yeah. Because you don't really, when you think of that era and you think of, when you think of Christopher Cross to Sailing, by the way, I should just preface this that I am also a huge yacht rock fan myself, which probably wouldn't surprise you, Vince, because we do have similar tastes in music from that era. But Yeah, it's interesting. When you listen to sailing, it's mixed in a way that wouldn't make you think that it's digital.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's got that very sort of nuanced soft string arrangement. I mean, right. It's very much, this is very much a songwriter's song as well. It's in fact this big hit, award-winning hit of 1980, fully recorded digitally. So it's just a really interesting thing that I stumbled across and decided, I'm going to listen to this album a little bit more and give it some more focused attention. And I actually really appreciated it and got me in touch with the things that I grew up with in that era. But also, yeah, Christopher Cross was a pretty darn good songwriter, singer, guitarist, too.
That would be an interesting case study to actually listen to that album and then ask yourself, okay, so considering the outboard, the hardware that they'd be going through, the kind of microphone that they're using, the amps, the synths as well, considering that they're not going through a tape machine, I assume, or are they? Would it be a tape multi-track and then that's digitally mastered after that, or is it entirely digital?
I mean, it's, going through the board, certainly. But yeah, the tape was a digital tape. Okay. So it was stored on tape, but it's all ones and zeros on that thing.
So, I mean, that's interesting because then it might kind of put into question, if you're wanting that sound, how important actually is the tape machine, the analog tape machine, as the end point to all of that, classic 70s and 80s analog studio gear. If you just have a digital recorder at the end of it, does it sound any different from, a real tape? Hey, this is an entire conversation topic for another episode, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. Mike, you were about to say something?
I was just curious if the digital media of the time resulted in a loss of quality that was perceptible to you.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, certainly modern. I didn't go out and buy a CD or vinyl. I just listened to it digitally, as in digital streaming services, good old Spotify and YouTube and all that. I'm actually not sure. It would be really interesting to look and see if we can grab data from these things. Like, maybe I could actually find a CD and see how different versions of that thing have actually manifested in these different commercial releases. Certainly for a big album and single release like that, it would be mastered and released multiple times, and there would be some interesting differences that exist there. Those early digital recording systems were just so weird, though. Everyone was doing some different things. 3M was different, doing different things from Sony. I mentioned before, Sony 13-bit. 13-bit seems really weird,
That's
getting
a funny
only
number,
some
isn't it?
80 dB of signal to noise, which is weird to think about, versus the 96 dB theoretical of 16-bit. Right. But yet Sony thought that was perfectly fine for discriminating classical music audiences.
Right.
That's what they used. So the 80s were a really weird and fun time, exciting time for digital, compared to what we have nowadays, where everything is so codified and so understood and accepted. So, yeah, it would be fun to look back on it, but I think that feels like... That kind of feels like a topic for another episode. So shall we agree to end this one then?
It's about time.
We better to end it now before we get onto it, other gear topics like that.
Oh, yeah. Let's do it. Okay, so this was episode 252 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on X at Game Audio Hour, where we post notices about episodes as they drop, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the social media landscape. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember any of what I just said is to go to gameaudiohour.com. So go ahead and do that while I try to think about responding to this guy that's asking for sample recommendations for chant and throat singing. I just got a message on Discord like 30 minutes ago asking about like this throat singing sound. Do you have any recommendations on a sample library for that type of thing? Anyone?
I'm sure the Montage can do it. Just grab one of those.
Montage?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, let's do that.
Come to the knife fight with a bazooka.
Yeah, Montage, 10 gigs of sample data. I'm sure some throat singing on there.